fleeting glimpses of things seen through a veil, darkly. Do we understand the meaning of these visions of life? Why we are here and how little of our existence we truly understand? Tonight we will talk of these things on The Other Side. Welcome to the program. I am Jim Harold and so glad to be with you. And in 18 years of doing these various shows, for me, the ultimate subject is the question of the afterlife, because we might not all see a UFO, we might not all see a ghost, we might not all see some kind of cryptid creature, but we're all going to have to make that journey along with our loved ones. Everybody listening to this, hopefully many, many years from now. But I do think it is the ultimate question. We have a great guest today to talk about that, Mark Ireland. He has a new book out. It's called The Persistence of the Soul, Mediums, Spirit Visitations, and Afterlife Communication. Mark is the co-founder of Helping Parents Heal, an organization with more than 24,000 members that assists bereaved parents worldwide. He has participated in mediumship research studies conducted by the University of Arizona and the University of Virginia, and he currently operates a medium certification program. He is also the author of Soul Shift. He lives in Washington State. We're so glad to have him with us today. Mark, welcome to the program. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Jim. It's wonderful to be here. Look forward to our conversation.
So it seems like this interest of yours, and it's more than an interest, I mean, it's become a vocation, really was born out of a great tragedy. Could you talk to me and talk to us about how that came to be and how you started to really pursue this question of the afterlife?
Sure. It was the unexpected passing of my youngest son, Brandon, who was 18 at the time, that thrust me into this. But what was a little different about me versus other folks who've had a child pass is I grew up with a father who was a prominent psychic and medium. He counseled Mae West, who I got to meet when I was 19 years old. People like Glenn Ford, and I even have a card from Amy Eisenhower addressed to him, congratulating him on marrying my mom in 1956.
Wow.
So that seems to indicate he probably counseled them as well. So I grew up with this stuff. It was a household where you couldn't get away with a lot because dad kind of always knew what was going on. But at the same time, I would see him do demonstrations, bringing through spirit communication to people who are deeply touched. And not just general stuff. I mean, first and last names, vocations, relationships, all kinds of things. So at that young age, I knew, wow, you know, we're more than just this body. There is another aspect to life and it goes on. So at least I had that more than just blind faith, which a lot of folks have to rely on. I had more of a knowledge, a direct experience, if you will. So fast forward, I didn't become my dad. I mean, he always said I was psychic, and I've had episodes that are pretty remarkable happen, but I never really focused on trying to develop that in a significant way or to practice it or anything as a vocation. I went to college, got a degree, went into the business world. I was married at 21 years of age. We had two boys. And it was when Brandon, again, the youngest of the two, was 18. He was hiking. He wanted to go for a hike behind our home to the top of the McDowell Mountains in Scottsdale, Arizona at the time. And that particular day, I did have kind of an ominous feeling about it, tried to talk him out of it, but he said, "We're going, Dad, like, stop worrying." And it was later that day that we received a distress call. And by the time we got back to the base of the mountain, because we'd been on the other end of town at the time, there were a horde of spectators, fire truck, ambulance, and then a helicopter. And within a short few minutes there, maybe 15 minutes, we were informed that he had passed. We didn't know the cause of death. Only his buddy, who tried to resuscitate him, could tell us what happened. He said that his Brandon had noted that his heart was beating rapidly, his arms felt kind of numb. He vomited, I guess, shortly before, but he was at least in a good spirits because he was joking about it, saying, "Oh, he vomited in his hair." But then he says, "I'm tired. I have to lay down," and he laid down, and that was it. I guess one of the earliest things that happened to kind of bring me back into my dad's field was, now by this time, my father had already passed, but my uncle, who had similar abilities, was still around. I reached out to him and he said, can I do anything for you? And I just said, well, if you have any kind of connection you can share, I'd really appreciate it. 3 days later, I think it was, I was in the mortuary. We connected by cell phone and he said, hey, Mark, I wanted to let you know something. Last night, I tried to make a connection, but I didn't get anything. However, this morning, I was doing my morning meditation, which is how I start every day. And your dad came to me. He said he was there for Brandon when he passed over. He was a little confused at first, but your dad helped him adjust. He wanted you to know, Brandon wanted you to know you're the best parents he ever could have had, which is the warm fuzzy thing we like to hear, but the evidence followed. He then said, your dad said Brandon's death was caused by a lack of oxygen in his bloodstream that caused his heart to fail. 2 days later, I talked to the physician who conducted the autopsy, and she said, Brandon had a severe asthma attack that drove down his blood oxygen levels, causing cardiac arrest.
Oh my.
So my uncle gave me the cause of death 2 days before the autopsy.
Wow, what a validation that was.
Yes, indeed. And I shared that with family and friends, and it helped everyone quite a bit. And that was just the first in a series of things that started unfolding to bring me back into this field on my own personal journey, to have connections with my son, but also to learn more about the field myself directly, instead of just how my dad viewed it or how he was engaged.
Now, I am curious about this, because I'm always interested in origin stories. Why? It sounds like you kind of stepped away from it for a number of decades. Can you describe that and maybe why you think you did?
Well, I mean, I always appreciated my dad's abilities. I was proud of him. I'd take friends to see his demonstrations. His main thing was actually a psychic demonstration. He'd do that in public venues that involves him putting 10 strips of Johnson & Johnson medical tape on. If you've ever seen or touched that, it's very sticky.
Yes.
And it's opaque.
Yeah.
Very opaque. And then 3 black blindfolds and more tape. And then he would ask people to send up messages written on pieces of paper. He would get the papers, answer questions, go way beyond what was ever written on the paper with a lot of details. So I think the thing was, there was a few reasons. First off, we were two different people. I'm probably a little more analytical, a little more cautious. And my dad was live for the moment type of person.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he enjoyed the challenge, you know, of skeptics and things like that. And I saw him having to constantly battle that with skeptics. And I think the other thing is, I felt like he was so good. There was no way I was going to be as good as him. And to try was, you know, not something that I looked forward to, always being compared to my dad. And I think I just had other interests. You know, I was interested in sports and things like that, and he really didn't have any interest in sports. So I guess I'd boil it down by saying we were really two different people. And even though I have seen that ability manifest in me at times, which has been cool, it's not really been a focal point in my life.
Now, do you yourself have psychic gifts? Or are you more a facilitator of finding people who do and connecting bereaved parents, for example, with people who do have psychic gifts? So I guess I'm basically asking, are you psychic or are you merely one who is interested and helps makes connections to people who are psychic?
So I would say it's a little of both, because I do have these abilities to some degree. Again, I've not tried to develop them to where I would have a practice or actually do readings for people. I just feel like there's a lot of responsibility that goes with that, especially when you're dealing with someone who's bereaved. So what I've done more, and also since I've been writing books and doing all the studies on this, I have more of a journalistic perspective. And I think the minute that I say, oh, I'm now a practicing psychic or medium, that kind of gets washed
right
away. So that's part of it. You know, maybe someday I'll decide to try that. I have done test readings with friends and came up with a lot of validations that things I didn't know that were pretty astounding. I think, you know, again, even though I'm not practicing, I'll give you an example, probably the most profound one that I've had happen as an adult. For 3 years, I was invited to speak at a church in San Francisco called the Golden Gate Spiritualist Church.
Mm-hmm.
And each time I went, I brought a medium friend, Tina Powers, who lived in Tucson, still lives in Tucson, to go with me. So I would do a talk and then she would do readings for the congregation. This particular time that we went there, she said, Mark, I think you're going to get a message to share with the congregation. Will you share it? And I said, sure, I will. And anyhow, she kept pestering me about this over and over, like, hey, Mark, you promise you'll share anything that you get? I said, yes, I will. So the day comes, we go to the church, and even walking into the church, he's reminding me again, like, if you get a message, will you share it? Yes, Tina, I will. So I went and I sat in the their healing room while we were waiting to start. Had about 30 minutes. So I sat on a bench to an organ or piano and just quieted my mind. And it actually went blank, which is pretty rare for me to get into that kind of meditative state. But while I was sitting there, the name popped into my awareness. It was Max. But then immediately Maxine. I thought, oh, maybe it's Maxine and not Max. I didn't hear this. I didn't see this. It came to me like an idea would come to you or a memory might come to you. Mm-hmm. It just popped in. Mm-hmm. I thought, okay. And that's all I got. So I went. Now, this church was founded in 1924 by a woman named Florence Becker, who by most accounts was similar to my father in her abilities. She passed away in 1970. And that's relevant to this story. So I go give my talk, and at the very end, I say, I don't know if this means anyone out here, but Tina made me promise that I'd share anything I got. Are the names Max or Maxine meaningful to anyone here? And the pastor who was there on the pulpit with us, his name was Dell, his jaw dropped, and he said, well, Max and Maxine were the name of twins born to the church founder, Florence Becker. They were delivered stillborn and grew up on the other side. He said, I think we know who is here right now. And then he took me upstairs and showed me a painting, I believe that Florence Becker did. It was a landscape painting with a long winding road with two little figures at the end. He says, that's Max and Maxine. So here's something that is so subtle that normally I probably wouldn't have shared because I would have thought I'm just making this up or imagining this.
Right.
That was actually very profound. And now I could see why Tina had pushed me to share that. So that's an example of something that I have had happen. It's just not with regularity.
Now, since your father had such great gifts, I believe that Dr. Richard Ireland.
Correct.
It would seem to me that you would be a tough audience for people who claim to have psychic powers. How do you approach people who say, hey, I'm psychic? Because I fully believe there are some people who have tremendous psychic powers and are using them for good. And then I also believe that, like any other walk of life, there are people who claim to be psychic who are no more psychic than I am and who are doing it to maybe make a quick buck. So how do you approach people who say, Mark, I'm a psychic. How do you deal with that?
I put them to the test. And that's what I do. So you had mentioned earlier, I have a medium certification program. And the reason I established that was because after my first book, Soul Shift, came out, I was being inundated with requests for, hey, who should I go see? Who's a good medium? And to that end, I knew about half dozen of them through my journey, but they were mostly celebrity mediums like Alison Dubois,
yeah,
and some others. So I thought, okay, these people have long wait lists. They tend to charge more than some people want to pay. So I thought there's got to be other talented people out there with this ability that are just undiscovered. So in 2014, I started this program. I reached out to Dr. Emily Williams Kelly at the University of Virginia Division of Perceptual Studies because I'd worked with her as a test sitter on an experiment she did to test medium abilities and learn some protocols that I might want to kind of copy to an extent how she did it. And then I have a friend, Tricia Robertson, who's in Scotland. She was the president of the Scottish Society of Psychical Research. She kind of helped me fine tune the protocols. And what I ended up doing was basically putting people through 5 blind readings where they have to do it via Zoom, mm-hmm, no video on. And all they know is the first name of the sitter. And so they have to give a reading that way. And then at the end, it's recorded, and then the sitter transcribes it and breaks it into individual statements that are either graded as correct, incorrect, or indeterminable. And they can assign bonus points if there's something very specific given that's meaningful to the sitter. For example, let's say that the medium says, well, I have your son here. I think his name starts with an A. And let's say the name is Aaron. So the person say, okay, that's pretty good. I'll give you 2 different levels of bonus. I'll give you a 2-point bonus because there's also a 5-point bonus. But let's say the medium says, okay, I've got your son here. His name is Aaron. Well, you got the name exactly right. So I'm going to give you the 5-point bonus. Or the medium says, your son Aaron's favorite food was pizza. Okay, that's good. It was. I'll give you 2 points. But If the medium says his favorite food was pizza with pepperoni, olives, and bell pepper, then that's exactly right. That maybe that's a 5-point bonus. That part's subjective. It's up to the sitter to grade those bonus points. But ultimately, we do a statistical grading for accuracy. And the way I have it today, and I've raised the bar 2 or 3 times over the years, is that the medium's got to score 75 or better. The percentage of accuracy is the first part. So they have to be at least 65% accurate, and then with bonus points, hit 75 or better. Or they could be 75% accurate with no bonus points and pass. I've had some people score in the mid to high 90s. Mm-hmm. Right now, a lot of people aren't passing, which actually I view as a good thing because I'm separating the wheat from the chaff, and we're getting, you know, really good people as a result of that.
Yeah, that, I mean, it is to be applauded because I think people, particularly who have had a loss, specifically with the child, as you're well aware, I can't even imagine it, and my great sympathies to you, but those folks are in a really vulnerable situation. So that's the group you've created for parents in that horrible situation. You've kind of created this group. It's called Helping Parents Heal. Tell us a little bit about it.
Sure. And those things are two different things. The certification program is something I did on my own, aside from Helping Parents Heal. Mm-hmm. However, if a medium wants to be added to the provider list that's recommended by Helping Parents Heal, they have to go through my process. But I have people on that have been through my process that are not providers for Helping Parents Heal.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, the organization actually started in an interesting way. Back in January of 2010, I was promoting my first book and doing some workshops and talks and things. And there was a woman who came to this, and she told me she had just moved to Arizona from Florida, and she'd come there because she wanted to meet like-minded people. As we spoke, she told me she was a medium and that she had recently connected with a woman whose son had died on a mountain, in a similar fashion to mine, not the same mountain, that she was in the Himalayas, but that she thought it might be helpful for us to meet. I gave her a copy of my book and said, can you pass this along to her and put a card in there? It was no more than a day or two later, this woman, Elizabeth Boyson, contacted me. I said, I want to meet you and your wife. So we connected. I met, and she says, well, I've started a group called Parents United in Loss. It's a Facebook group, but I'm going to do my very first in-person meeting, you know, a week from now or 2 weeks from now. I'd like you to be my first speaker. So I agreed to that. I went there and I spoke, and the meeting went well. And then she started holding these on a monthly basis. Fast forward to late 2011, I was leaving a corporate job. I was talking to Tina Powers, who I mentioned earlier, and she said, you know, Mark, I think your real mission in life is to help other parents who have been through the same thing as you. And maybe you could think about setting up an organization to do that. So as I started mulling this over, I thought, well, you know, Elizabeth's already doing this and it's very effective, but it's just one group. What if we had a website, and what if we had a newsletter, and what if we blueprinted her process and branched out and had other affiliates start in other locations? So I approached her with the idea. She was all over it. And I said, well, maybe we could call it something else, like Helping Parents Heal. And she jumped on that and said, I love that name. I really didn't like the name Parents United in Loss. So since doing that, it's just exploded, which is good and bad. It's bad because a lot of people are suffering. Good that the resource is there for them. And there are other bereaved parents groups. We're the only one that allows open discussion of spiritual experiences and afterlife evidence. And that is really the hope element, along with other kinds of support that helps these people heal. We now have over 25,000 members. We have over 100 affiliates worldwide, not just in the U.S. And then we've had 2 conferences. Our last one in Phoenix in 2022 drew 900 people, which was the capacity of the hotel. And the people at the hotel were really leery about and concerned about having a group of bereaved parents there and thought it was going to be a real downer. Well, they actually at the end said, you're the best group we've ever had. The energy was so high. And that's because these folks got together and we had a great lineup of presenters that brought hopeful messages to them. And they also met other people in the same boat as them.
Yeah,
that formed those friendships. And it just really helped. But we have another one scheduled in August of 24. We anticipate 1,000 people at that, and we will probably, you know, have a waiting list, I'm sure. But that's how it's evolved.
I have to believe that's so important because I'm a parent, but knock on wood, and God forbid anything happen, my kids are safe and sound to date, something every parent worries about. And as much as I can, you know, have genuine sympathy for bereaved parents like yourself, I can't understand it because it's not happened to me, and I hope it never does happen to me, God forbid. But the point being is that no matter how well-meaning someone else is, if they have all the true sympathy in their heart, they really can't possibly understand a loss of that depth unless it's happened to them. That's my thought on it.
Well, that's exactly right, I think. And that's why it's so effective to get these folks together, because they know that the other person has experienced the same thing and they can relate to them at that level and not just offer platitudes. Or, you know, a lot of folks try, but they don't know what to say, you know, and it's because
yeah.
they've not been.
What do you say? I mean, it's kind of like dealing with someone who has a horrible illness, maybe a terminal illness. You know, should I say something? Should I not say something? Should I try to gloss over it? You don't know what to say. It's not out of any lack. I'm sure there are people who are not empathetic, but I think most people are, especially a fellow parent. But you don't know what to say. You don't know, should I say something? Should we talk about this? Will that make it better? Will that make it worse? Yeah, exactly.
And these parents not just meeting and being able to relate, but allowing them to share these spiritual experiences is huge, because some of them have tremendous signs or things. I'll give you an example of one that happened to us 6 months after Brandon's passing. And again, this is a catalyst for me. I probably never would have done any of this and been able to serve so many people had it not happened. So as much as I'd love to have him back in a physical form, you know, it pushed me to do more than I was probably ever going to do. So 2 weeks after Brandon's passing, I spoke to an intuitive. She said that within 6 months, we would see, or I would see Brandon at the side of my bed and feel his presence. Well, 6 months later, it wasn't me, but my wife was sitting at the foot of our bed and felt Brandon's presence and saw him as a shadow figure out of her peripheral vision. Now, what made this even more compelling was before we'd gone on a trip that we just returned from, we loaned Brandon's bass guitar, because he was a bassist, to a friend that we'd met named James Linton, who was a musician, a guitar player, composer, singer. And James had been on the mountain the same day Brandon died, and he tried to help, but he got there too late. We met him because he'd signed into the online obituary. So here he is. We've loaned him the bass guitar. Susie has this experience. The very next day, she gets a call from James. And James says, Susie, I've got something to tell you, but I don't know how to tell you. And she thought he'd broken the bass guitar. But no, he says, well, I was sitting in my studio recording a song. And while I was in there, I felt another presence with me. And I saw a shadow figure out of my peripheral vision. And then I thought I was hallucinating. I went and got water. I ate food. I took a shower. But each time I came back, it got stronger. I saw flashes of white light. And then I finally caved in and said, okay, Brandon, what do you want? And he said at that point, he felt guided to redo the lyrics and bass line of the song that became under the title, The Other Side. He said, this is the best song I've ever written, but I didn't write it. Now, whether you accept the channeling of the song or not, which I do, but you've got to see the remarkable nature of both of these experiences happening in successive days with him having no knowledge of my wife's experience.
Yeah, that's something else. And The Other Side. Very interesting. So what forms do communication take? You know, some people work with psychic mediums. Some people try to use things like EVP or other kind of divining tools and those kind of things. In your experience, how do the communications usually come through?
I think, you know, it's best for people to try and have a direct communication if they can. And I think one is to develop a meditative practice, or like you could have a guided meditation where you sit quietly and you just imagine that you're in a place maybe that your loved one liked to be, whether that's by a river or in the forest, in the mountain, by the beach, and just quietly invite them. And then oftentimes people will have that sense that they have been joined. They may hug. They might actually feel a tapping on themselves. I would say, you know, I had an instance of that. That was the first thing that happened even before my uncle's message that I think happened to me a day or two after it. I went into a darkened room, which was actually a walk-in closet, shut the door, and just quietly meditated and silenced my mind. And within a reasonable period of time, I saw an image in my mind's eye of my son. He was like glowing and smiling and happy and joyful. So that made me feel good. But right after that, then I saw a symbol go by, and it was a cross within a loop at the top. I'd seen them, but I didn't know what they represented. So I, being the analytical type, had to go Google it to see, well, what does that mean? Discovering it, it's the Ankh, the oldest cross of human history, about 5,000 years old, I believe, with the lower portion representing physical life, the upper portion loop representing eternal life. So what I got was a coded message, as I saw it, that said, Brandon's joyful, he's in eternal life. And had I already known what the symbol meant, it wouldn't have been as meaningful, because I could have dismissed it and just said, well, my subconscious was trying to make me feel good. But there I got something that I had to go find out what it meant to give meaning to the experience. So that's one way. Another way that's pretty effective, because folks are often very emotional after a passing, is before they go to bed, is in a prayerful way, ask for a visit and ask to be able to remember it. I've had this happen a few times. Only once though, I had where it was an extremely vivid, lucid experience where I saw Brandon and communicated with him, and it was more vivid than waking reality. Those are very rare. Only had that happen twice in my life, once with Brandon and once with a deceased aunt. So that's another thing you can do, is try and get it in a dream state, because there you're going to be in that altered consciousness and you're not tied to the emotions of, you know, waking life as much. For other folks, if that doesn't work, you can do, there's a process that was developed by a Dr. Alan Botkin, using EMDR to get into an altered state. And some people have remarkable experiences. He's no longer practicing, but I believe they've trained others to do that.
I interviewed him years ago.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
And I think he stumbled upon it by accident while trying to treat PTSD patients who had been in Vietnam and served. And some of them experienced meeting people they killed in battle who forgave them. Or another man, he had kind of adopted this little girl who had been killed over there. And she appeared to him and gave him a hug and said she loved him. So, you know, that process is available to people too. I know a couple who actually went through that. It was a man and wife in the Bay Area, San Francisco Bay Area, and their son had passed. So he went first, and it took a long time for him to get into this altered state, but he did. And he met the son, and he talked to the son, and the son said, well, this isn't going to work for mom, I'm just telling you. And he also said, ask mom about the color code book. Well, then the wife went in. The husband didn't say anything to her because he didn't want to influence her, but it did not work for her. But then after her session was over, he said, is there something about a color code book? And then she said, oh yeah, we were, the son and her had been discussing something called the color code book before his death. It's a book, I guess, associating different colors with different types of emotions or something.
Oh, okay.
I thought there was a pretty remarkable experience, not just to have the experience, but to come back with some validation and evidence from it.
From your own experiences and the experiences of others who you trust, what do those who've passed tell us about the afterlife? I mean, we have some people who believe in heaven and hell. We have some people who believe in nothing. We have some people who believe in reincarnation and a host of other beliefs that I'm not sharing right now. But what do they say happens when we die?
Yeah, first off, I think to even believe in an afterlife, you have to come to the realization that consciousness is primary. It's not a byproduct of your brain type of phenomena. Granted, we have a brain. It affects our experiences in this world. I think it's there as a reducer of consciousness, a filter, if you will, that helps us survive in the physical world. And we're here for experience to grow and learn, sometimes through suffering, sometimes through struggles. But when we leave, I think we go, and I look at the near-death experience research and those accounts a lot. I take that into consideration. And what's described is actually very similar to something my dad brought through in a trance state in, I think, 1960 that I have. And it's described as you're going into more of a mental state. You're embraced in a way where love is the primary environmental construct, I guess you would say. You're surrounded by this love. You're seeing expansive colors that you've never seen on earth before. The emotions of earth that probably are tied to the brain, such as fear and anger and those things, they're kind of gone because they're not part of your core spiritual essence, your soul. I think it's a rather than heaven and hell, I view it as a hierarchy of consciousness or a gradation mm-hmm. based on your spiritual evolution. So I think there are higher levels or higher realms, you know, so a Christ-like person might end up being at a higher level of realm. And I think they can come down to try and affect or influence or help others at a lower level. I don't know that those at the lower level can go up to that. I think it's a vibratory thing. As we all know in this world, you know, if you know anything about quantum mechanics, energy and vibration is what makes up the physical world. It's just energy.
I was just literally reading an article last night in Popular Mechanics, of all things, that scientists, there's been some very interesting studies about the brain, quantum physics, and consciousness. And it's, you know, there's scientists really coming around to the idea that we do tap into this universal consciousness. It's not just for the spiritual folks anymore. And it's really nice to see that there is, you know, some folks with, you know, real scientific backgrounds and credentials who are looking at this and saying, and I forget the exact details, but it was something about the microtubules in our brain. And just really interesting to see science coming around to something that I think spiritual folks have known for millennia.
Yeah.
So let's say somebody is in a situation like you are, where they've lost a child or those kind of things. How can they connect with your organization?
Well, my website is markirelandauthor.com. Mm-hmm. That's M-A-R-K, Ireland, like the country, markirelandauthor.com. On that site, you'll find links to all these other resources. I have a link to the Certified Medium site. If someone's looking for a medium that's been vetted, you can go there. I have a link to the Helping Parents Heal website there as well. So you can see if there's a chapter or affiliate location near you. We have Zoom meetings all the time with predominant speakers. We've had, you know, Raymond Moody, Evan Alexander. We've had mediums that would come on and do readings for the folks that are on there, like Maureen Hancock. She's on the East Coast. John Holland's a friend of mine. He's another prominent medium. So they can participate in these Zoom meetings. They can also look at, you know, the conference, see if they want to come to the conference. There are tons of videos they can see. So there's all kinds of support resources on that site. And then if people want to see a video of my dad to understand what I'm talking about with his abilities, I have a link there as well to my videos of my dad on a website I put together. They're on YouTube as well. But if you go to my website, you'll find a link that takes you to all the videos that are available. I think the best one is really his appearance on the Steve Allen Show in 1971.
Oh, wow.
It's really impressive, and it gives you a representation of what it was like to sit through one of his. The biggest difference was if you went into a room with 100 people, he'd give a message to 50 or 60 of them. So, you know, anyone alleging audience plans would be a little challenged with that because he just gave too many people a message and with too much detail and information. That's what I'd recommend. Go there and you'll find links to all those, as well as my own media page with other interviews I've done. I was in a Discovery Channel episode that was tied to that University of Arizona research that I was involved with. There's a short documentary on my story as well. So all this stuff is there.
And then finally, I want to, because we haven't talked about the book specifically that much, tell us a little bit about the book and what people can expect if they pick up The Persistence of the Soul, Mediums, Spirit Visitations, and Afterlife Communication.
Sure. So my first book was more this memoir on my journey where I go through my process that I pretty much explained on this interview. The only thing I didn't touch on was I had 4 medium readings with people who didn't know who I was. That were really profound and had a lot of overlapping information. The new book, Persistence of the Soul, it's a little bit different approach because it's almost like 2 books in one. On one hand, I've got these personal experiences that are there, but then I also bring in science and academic information to support those experiences. So I talk about, you know, the early studies from the Society of Psychical Research, I talk about the research that was done by Tricia Robertson and Archie Roy, who was a prominent scientist in Scotland, the work they did and their research, and then ongoing research being done by the Winbridge Research Center and Dr. Julie Beischel in Tucson. So I bring in those elements as well. I have a chapter on religion and these phenomena, because I know there's a lot of people of more of the fundamentalist religious lean that have a fear or feel trepidation about these topics. So I address that directly. And I think I put people's minds at ease. You know, most folks who would read that would understand. Because really, a lot of these phenomena are described in the New Testament and are embraced. But people still have this fear about it. I've got a chapter on reincarnation, because I have come around to thinking, I think there is something to reincarnation. And the reason I think that is kind of twofold. One is, if life, physical life, is about progression and soul refinement, it's probably pretty hard to do that in one lifetime, especially if you had a short life. So maybe it requires more, you know, a series of these kinds of lives to progress that way. And also, the research has been done by people like Dr. Ian Stevenson at the University of Virginia over the years, that would go to these tribal areas and remote villages, heard stories about a child, young child, saying they used to be a different person, and give the name and their relationship to other people in the family of a tribe that was 300 miles away. And then he would go to the other tribe and ask, did someone of this name live here, and were they married to this person? And so he has many, many cases of that where that were validated. So it seems to make sense. And Jim Tucker at University of Virginia has continued that work. And you've probably talked to him, or at least seen
him. Yes.
So I think there's something to that. It, I even have a story in there about an experience I had when I was 3 years old and things I told my father that I obviously don't remember today. But it coincides with what the research says, which is that kids have these memories up until maybe age 5, 6, 7, and then it fades away. And then they get, you know, embroiled in the life that we have here on this earth. So I touch on reincarnation. I touch on fraudulent mediums and how to avoid them. I do have a chapter on that, because there was a woman who lost her son, and she was introduced to my wife and I by a therapist. And we were talking about our experiences with qualified mediums, and she got impatient and was driving by this storefront that said psychic reader, and she went in there, and this woman tried to dupe her, and it actually made her very sad and depressed. So I use that as an example of what to avoid. And then, you know, I talk about skeptics, true open-minded skepticism versus the debunker type, the people who already have their mind made up. And they're married to secular materialism, and they're atheists. You know, they think that they want to believe that everything's just made of matter. And if it's not made of matter, it's not real. So I address that, and the fact that some of them actually go to lying and cheating to try and make people in this field look bad instead of really examining the evidence and being truthful about it. But like you said, some scientists now are shifting, because the question of consciousness has never been solved by science, and it never will if they keep looking in the brain. They've got to get outside of their own way and be open to broader scope of evidence. And I think that is happening gradually. And even if it proceeds at a slow pace, just because academia is still married to materialism, that, you know, I think there's a groundswell of interest from the lay people out there like us, you know, and it's going to be a tidal wave of that. That's just going to steamroll that. And they're not just accepting what academia has to say. So academia's got to come around and do the research into these areas, because what's more important than, you know, what happens to us after this life? I can't think of too many things.
Agreed. Our guest has been Mark Ireland. The book is The Persistence of the Soul, Medium Spirit Visitations and Afterlife Communication. And Mark, I'm assuming, I know you can get the book at Amazon, and I'm assuming anywhere fine books are sold, correct?
Sure. I'm with a major publisher, Inner Traditions, out of the East Coast. Today, I'm in Barnes & Noble and Amazon, actually on 11 different countries. Amazon has sites. I'm on all of those. And then independent bookstores, well, if they don't have it, they can order it. Same for Barnes & Noble. If they don't have it, they can order it. But it's available pretty much anywhere.
Excellent. And we'll have a link in the show notes as well. Mark Ireland, thank you so much for joining us on the program today.
Absolutely, Jim. I enjoyed it.
And thank you for tuning into the program. We appreciate it. and keep exploring those mysteries. And take care. Bye-bye, everybody.